Today's Teisho is on Case 75 in the Book of Serenity. Case 75 is entitled Ruyan's Constant Principle. Introduction. Even as you call it thus, it's already changed. Where knowledge doesn't reach, avoid speaking of it. Here, is there any investigation or not? Case. Ruyan asked Yantu, what is the fundamental constant principle? Yantu said, moving. Ruyan said, when moving, what then? Yantu said, you don't see the fundamental constant principle. Ruyan stood there thinking. Yantu said, if you agree, you are not yet free of sense and matter. If you don't agree, you'll be forever sunk in birth and death. Verse. The round pearl has no hollows. The great raw gem isn't polished. What is esteemed by people of the way is having no edges, removing the road of agreement. Senses and matter are empty. The free body, resting on nothing, stands out unique and alive. Thank you, everyone, for being here today in person and online. I haven't spoken to the group in about a year. I just haven't done a Teisho in about a year. So I thought what I'd like to do is give just a little bit of background about how Zen practice found me, and then talk a little about this koan, which is kind of fresh for me. But first, I wanted to go back and talk about Sesshin. So we finished our May Sesshin early in June, and just a strong encouragement for anyone who has either considered going to Sesshin down at Murray Grove. Sesshin is really the heartbeat of Zen practice. But either if you have considered going, please go. And if you've done a weekend, if your schedule allows, maybe try to do the 5 days or the 7 days if it's in May. Just a strong encouragement to do Sesshin, because things happen in Sesshin. The interaction between all of us in Sesshin, with minimal contact, minimal verbal contact, minimal eye contact, things present themselves in a way that can't be duplicated any other way. I think Kurt says there's nothing else in the world like Sesshin, and that I have found that to be true over my time of Zen practice. So just a strong encouragement for everyone to consider if you haven't gone. I wanted to pick up on something that Kurt talked about I think it was June 1st. It was the Saturday of the May Sesshin. I don't remember the koan. I think it may have been the one with I alone am holy in heaven and earth. But he used a model that has really stuck with me. I haven't heard it before, but it's kind of the difference of the ways of looking at Sangha. And those of you who were there may remember this, and I'm certainly not going to do it justice, but what I heard was that there's like a planetary model of Sangha, like a solar system, where there is, I think the phrase was, spiritual virtuoso, that is like the sun. And that the gravity of that individual practitioner, person, who is recognized by the Sangha, and maybe even an authoritative organization that endorses that person. That person's gravity holds everything together. And the Mercury ring, the ring of Mercury would be the people who are senior and maybe just about to become or preparing to become spiritual virtuosos. And then there are the people who come every once in a while to practice. And then outside of that, there's a ring that are the supporters who may not practice at all, but contribute financially or otherwise. Then there's a ring of people who are kind of like fans or supporters, and then outside of that are detractors or critics. And you know, I had that view of Sangha for quite a while. In my old group that I sat with, and we'll talk about that more in just a minute. But the other model that Kurt presented, which I find completely compelling, is more of an atomic model. Now, I'm a chemical engineer by education, and I took physical chemistry. It was like the junior year weed out course for the chemical engineers. But the atomic model is very appealing, where Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, the three jewels of Buddhism, are the nucleus of the atom, and unshakable, immovable. And we practitioners are like electrons that are the force field that hold the Sangha together. So, you know, Kurt, individual Kurt, is, yes, he's my teacher, he is my teacher. I think he's our teacher. He's a teaching electron, and we're all practicing electrons. And I just find that so appealing. And the big point for me that he made in that Taisho is that he learns from us. So it's really big mind, and the universal vastness that underlies us all, as it says in the Shinjin Mei, that is the teacher. That is the teacher. So the interaction of Sangha in this atomic model with Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha as the nucleus is the teacher. I've often thought, you know, when Kurt talks about Taisho, which, by the way, I wanted to mention, Taisho, if anybody has to drop off, Taisho will not be tomorrow night. Kurt will not be back in time. Dokusan. Dokusan will not be tomorrow night. It'll be Thursday night at 7. So 4th of July at 7. He'll be back this week. So where was I?
The atomic model.
Oh, yes. When Kurt talks about Dokusan, he talks about presenting to the teacher. And you know, you might think, well, why doesn't he say, you come to Dokusan and you present to me? It's because he is an electron. He's a teaching electron. But with that vastness underneath, the interaction is the teacher. He learns from us. We learn from him. It's such a beautiful model, and I've never heard it explained that way. So I just wanted to reinforce that. That Taisho should be up on the website if you want to go check it out. I think it's June 1st is that particular Taisho. Okay, so let me just spend a few minutes on my background and how Zen practice found me, since some of you I haven't really met or talked to in the past. I grew up in Nashville, Tennessee. I left when I went to grad school, but I was there for my childhood. And my parents, you know, they were FDR Democrats. My mom was the first in her family to go to college. They went to Berea College in Kentucky, which is an interesting college because you don't pay tuition, you work. So the students provide the labor for the college, and there's no tuition. And it was intended originally to help people from Appalachia, you know, go to college. My dad's father went to college, but they met at college, and they were married for 71 years. They both died in 2022. My mom was 97, my dad was 98. So for the last 10 years, they were like one person. You know, they had just been together so long. I have one sibling. She's 5 years older. She still lives in the Nashville area, and I get down there quite a bit. So, the connection to Zen practice is I had an aunt. Half of my aunts and uncles went to Berea, but two of them went to grad school. One went to the University of Wisconsin in the 50s, and the other went to the University of Chicago in the late 50s. And they brought Unitarian Universalism into the family from Wisconsin and Chicago. And by the time I came along, we were going to the Unitarian Church. And it's just so amazing to me that we do sesshin down at Murray Grove, where Universalism, you know, I think Unitarianism and Universalism combined in 1959, but Universalism was founded in the late 1700s at Murray Grove. That Potter Church is where Universalism came into being. So it's just this amazing, you know, full circle for me personally to do sesshin down there. So as far as meditation goes in my life, the first anything to do with meditation, I mean, I was a rambunctious kid, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute, but the first meditation was right before church service started. So, you know, when the kids went out to Sunday school, everybody was together in the sanctuary initially in the UU church in Nashville, and there was a minute of silence, and we would sit there, and the kids, you could feel them stirring. My cousin and I would be kicking each other, just waiting to go up and get our graham crackers and Hawaiian punch in Sunday school. And 1 minute of silence, and then boom, the kids would take off. That was the very first instance of anything like meditation that I remember in my life. Later, I developed a pretty serious drinking habit. By the time I left grad school, I was drinking alcoholically, and I'm a recovering alcoholic. I've been sober in a 12-step program since 1990, so that's just celebrated 34 years. And in that 12-step program, which I will not associate myself with, but you probably know what I'm talking about related to alcohol, there's a step, the 11th step, which talks about, suggests prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, and that God as we understood him is in italics. And I had no use for God. I'm not a God person, not a prayer or anything like that. But something about meditation, I heard people talking about it, it planted itself in my mind from the very first few months of sobriety. I went to a retreat at St. Elizabeth's in Parsippany. There's a college up there, St. Elizabeth's. And this was it wasn't a sesshin at all. It was a retreat with a big Saturday evening ice cream bonanza. It was one of these recovery retreats. And there was a guy there, I think his name was Stewie, like Brooklyn Stewie or something like that. And he had this reputation. I only had a couple of years of sobriety at the time. He had this reputation for leading guided meditations. So we sat in the library, probably 50 of us sat in the library, and this guy with this accent, this heavy Brooklyn accent, was, you know, did this guided meditation. And I'm sure you're probably familiar, you know, you start at the top of your head and you first relax your body one part at a time. And then he started talking about, okay, so you're walking through the forest and you come to this path and you turn to the left and you go down this path. Anyway, he walked through, and where our eyes are closed, he walked through this scenario of where I'm in the woods, it's beautiful, I'm walking down this path, and I find myself as a child. You know, I guess this would be called inner child work. I'm not sure, but he had learned this from somebody. But anyway, we went through this thing for about half an hour. And before too long, you know, you hold hands with your inner child, you greet your inner child, you sit with your inner child, you stand up and you tell your inner child, I'm here for you anytime you want, all that sort of thing. By the time it was done, I was bawling my eyes out. And when they brought us very quickly up out of that state, there was like this volleyball-sized glow in my lap. I know it was Macchio, which is like a little bit of a hallucination, but but it something happened. I mean, it just like implanted that maybe there's something to this meditation that I'm really not aware of. So that was like 2 or 3 years of sobriety. Then by the time I was like 12 or 13 years, I had joined the UU Church in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and I started going over there all the time. And one Sunday, I saw something in the bulletin at the service, and it said Zazen, like Z-A-Z-E-E-N. It was a misspelling for Zazen. I thought it was like Zumba, you know, or some kind of exercise class or something like that. Anyway, I stayed, you know, I didn't have anybody in my life at the time, and I would go to Bethlehem, go to church, hang out over in Bethlehem. It's nice. It's a nice town to walk around in. So I stayed for Zazen. It started, I think, at 5 o'clock, and it turned out that it was Zazen. And it was a monk from the area who brought Zazen to the church. The mats were just like, it was a Rinzai Sangha. Mats were just like this. And I sat that night. We started at about 5:30, I think, and with tea afterward and refreshments, we were done at like 10. Now, the thing that hooked me, so for all of my life up till that point, and this was in my early 40s, I had the Sunday blues. I lead a group at Lafayette College during the semester, and one of the students, they were interviewing me, and I told them about this, and they said, oh, that's called the Sunday scaries. I hadn't heard that before, but maybe the Sunday scaries, you know, where the weekend's over. For me, in the old days, I would be hung over because of the weekend of drinking, but the weekend's over, work is coming, or school is coming, and there's this blueness that would settle in at about 2 o'clock on Sunday afternoon. It's like, oh, Monday's coming. I had that from first grade, and I had just tried to deal with it, and nothing seemed to work. That very, very first period of Zazen, you know, we only sat for maybe an hour in 25-minute blocks with Keenan in the middle. So it was a relatively short period of sitting. The Sunday blues were gone. They never came back. Something about sitting and hanging out with those people and going home at 10 o'clock at the time when I would most of the time be dreading Monday. Something about that experience just opened up. It just opened things up. I can't explain it, but it hooked me to Zazen. And so I started practicing regularly with that group. I took Jukai in 2005. So I've been practicing 20 years now. I took Jukai in 2005. I got the Mu Koan. It took me 3 years to work through the Mu Koan. Now we weren't sitting as much as we do here in Cold Mountain. We were only doing Zazen Kai once a week, so it was a whole different game, which I'll talk more about later. But it took me 3 years to pass Mu and the follow-on question, which is where does Mu come from? Those two koans took me 3 years. I fully ordained in 2010. And I entered the realm of the garment, the clergy garment. We were very formal. We were a very formal sangha. We were loosely associated with Daibosatsu Zendo up in the Catskills in those days. So I did a little bit of training up there, but mostly I had the koromo, the outer garment, the kimono, the obi, the belt, the Romo, the shinigi, which is like the thin formal robe, the kesa, which is like the true replica of the Buddha's garment that has to be folded in a very specific way, because especially at Sesshin, you have to sit for sutra recitation in that formal garb, which is very warm in the summer if it gets really hot. And you have to be out of that into your regular robes and sitting in like 5 minutes, including a bathroom break. So it was really, it had to be really fast. And there's this particular way of folding it. Some of you may have experienced it, I'm not sure, but particular way of folding it. Anyway, all of this garment stuff taught me a very powerful lesson. There was practice. There was a practice element to it. Not only practice makes perfect, but practice as in losing yourself, losing sense of self in the donning and doffing of these garments. So I'm really grateful for that. In those days, we did weddings. I did some weddings. I did funerals. I prepared. I was with people when they died. I prepared bodies for cremation. We crushed bones and put them in a little urn for the family in a certain order. I did all that sort of stuff, very formal. And eventually, you know, we did dokusan, did koans, everything we do here. The roots of that practice, you know, Kurt has trained at Daibosatsu Zendo. He talks about that. He was gone by the time I got there. But I also did sesshins out in Seattle with one of Kurt's Dharma brothers. But at some point, I had a falling out with my teacher. I won't go into the details, but I had a falling out. And I looked online for Zen Sanghas close by when I saw Cold Mountain and I read Kurt's bio. It's like, I know exactly what that is. I am so there. And I came down here and in 2015. And at the time, I was still working full-time. I was living part-time in India, so I was working in India back and forth, and then eventually in Europe back and forth. But I stopped. I did as much practice as I could, as many Saturdays, as many sessions as my work schedule would allow. But then in 2019, I semi-retired, and I'm working, I don't know, 25, 50 hours a month now, so it's much better. So I can make all the sessions and most of the Saturdays. So that's kind of how I landed at Cold Mountain. And I have to say that, you know, I talked to Kurt early on about the traditional aspects of the practice at my previous Sangha. And, you know, I thought the garments were the tradition. I thought the garments and the movements and the memorizing sutras and those sorts of practice elements, I thought that was the tradition. And Kurt corrected me. The tradition is Zazen. And I did not meet Zazen until I got to Cold Mountain. And there's a tear in my voice. I am so grateful to this Sangha for the atomic model, the amount of Zazen that we do. I've said this before. I said it last year when I did Taisho. Especially since COVID, the amount of Zazen that I have done personally since COVID exceeds the amount of Zazen I did the first 15 years of practice. I'm sitting between 9 and 14 hours a week now. And previously it was 3 maybe. So our Sangha offers many opportunities to sit. We have Monday, Wednesday, Friday, Sunday morning, every other Saturday. Other people lead groups. I mean, I don't want to put anybody on the spot, but there's a group at the North Brunswick Library that Nathan is leading. Sandy leads morning sits. Jaru leads sits, I believe. I lead sits at Lafayette. So there's a lot of opportunity to practice in this Sangha. And that is precious. It's invaluable. It's amazing. So I keep sitting. Okay, so that's background. Now let's move to the koan. And you know, we hear often. Let me get a sip of tea here. I have two cups of tea here. I love to drink things. You know, we hear a lot about encountering our obstacles. I'm not going to go into what a koan is. Everybody knows what a koan is, I believe. But encountering obstacles. Koans bring obstacles to the foreground and give us the opportunity to look at them. and embed with them and be absorbed by them. And Kurt often talks about the principle of cleaning up karma, cleaning up karma. And this koan helped me understand this in a new way. You know, when I think of karma, typically, I usually think of karma like there's that John Lennon song, I Have the 45, for those of you who know what a 45 is. Mm-hmm. It's instant karma. Instant karma is going to get you, you know. And karma is like the Eastern version of the Golden Rule, you know, that sort of thing. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you, that kind of thing. Like if you put good karma into the world, you'll get good karma back. That's kind of the way I've always viewed it. But, you know, really karma is infinite. There's the cultural karma of where we live, not only community but country and you know globe. There's the karma of evolving to be this form, this human form. There's that karma. But there's also the karma that causes these obstacles, and yet I have no control over. And I'll give you a very specific example for myself. So when I was about 6 months old, I had severe colic. And I don't have children, but I read a New Yorker article about colic a few years ago, and it kind of confirmed this, that colic is extremely disruptive to a family, because colic is like this major digestive disorder. It lasted 6 months. And it creates extreme amounts of crying in a child. And it's really annoying. It's annoying for people because it's the crying, but it also inflames a lot of worry and concern and lack of control. I mean, the family can't really do anything about it. So it can really create a dynamic in a family that has long-lasting effects. And I've gotten in touch with that happened in my family. There, you know, I'm the youngest, and I'm the only male child, and I had this severe colic. And it created a very, very quiet sense of separation. So my sister also was ill. She had scarlet fever. It affected her vision at like 3 or 4 years old. So there was a lot of concern about her, and that experience for my parents and my sister bonded the three of them, I think. This is the way I'm seeing it, bonded them. And then I came along, I had colic, and it was kind of like the three of those bonded with concern for me. And if I look back at family photos, even before I remember the situations, it was sort of like them and me. So this karma, you know, I didn't have anything to do with that. I'm not saying I was a victim, but as I grew into consciousness and sensed that dynamic in the family as a child, it created this sense of, wait a minute, I didn't, you know, what's wrong? What is wrong? So there was this, something's wrong. What is wrong? I don't get it. What the hell? You know, all of this kind of thing. And that created anger and frustration. And in some cases, despair. You know, I said some of my family is still down there. I have taken, since I moved up to the east, I live in Easton, Pennsylvania. I moved up there in 1988. I have been to Nashville. Like, I've flown to Nashville at least 275 times in those periods to try to make up what is wrong. And it comes from, I believe, that part of it at least is from that experience. So with that as a background, I wanted to talk about something I heard this week. Really, from the framework of the 12-step program that I'm involved with, I still go to meetings a couple times a week. There's a framework of we share experience, strength, and hope. Some of you may have heard that before. It's sort of a framework that keeps the individual members from prescribing for others, like you need to do this or you need to do that. It comes from I myself have experienced this. This is the strength that I learned, and this is the hope that I have, I personally have. So I wanted to talk about that in this koan in those terms, experience, strength, and hope. And let's start with hope. I heard something this week that really jumped out to me, and this was on a podcast, and it's this social worker, I think she's in Texas, and her name is Brené Brown. I don't know if anybody is familiar with her or not. But she deals primarily in shame and vulnerability. So I'm new to her. I just heard this and I looked into it a little bit. So kind of her specialty is shame and vulnerability. And her perspective in this podcast is that kind of we're not okay. We're not okay right now. And, you know, she talked about a racial reckoning, you know, all the way back, really to the founding of the country, but even, you know, Rodney King, what was the most recent one? George Floyd. There's this racial reckoning in the country. We have climate change. We've experienced that dramatically this week in this area. The pandemic, Gaza, Ukraine, you know, the election, the debate, my goodness, we're not okay. Our own personal stuff. You know, I myself have had a rough year. My wife has had her third cancer bout. Some of you know this, has had her third bout of cancer in 12 years. And this one was particularly unpleasant. She's fine. I mean, MRI's clear. Checkup is the thing melted away. No problem. You know, but still, it's a dark cloud. So kind of we're not okay is the underlying of this. And her perspective is that there's a sense of lack of agency in the culture that is creating this. And that agency would be defined, at least in her terms, as belief in the capacity to change. Belief in the capacity to change. And she referenced someone, I was drinking in these years, so I don't know this guy, but it's C.R. Snyder. I've never heard of him before. I guess he would be classified a pop psychologist in the 80s. And his thing is that hope is not an emotion. You know, normally it's hope, at least from the traditional perspective, hope would be the positive emotional state that presents itself when things go the way I think they ought to go. Maybe that's what hope is. And it's really, in his terms, it's more of a cognitive behavioral process. So hope as a process really jumped out to my ears. And then further looking into that, the three components of the process from C.R. Snyder's standpoint are goal, pathway, and agency. So I'm sure Brené Brown has studied the Snyder guy and saw, you know, lack of agency as the key. But to spin this a little bit into Zen terms, the goal, you know, the goal is waking up. You know, I want to wake up. I myself want to experience Daikensho. I want to wake up. That is a goal. In my previous sangha, that was not talked about. In our sangha, that is talked about. Kurt references Daikensho often. That is the goal. That's my personal goal, and I think that's the goal of everything. Everything is helping us wake up. Everything is helping me wake up. Everyone, I think the last Taisho this came out, everything is waking up in its own time. Even Donald Trump is waking up in his own time. So that is the goal. The pathway, Zazen, Zen practice, sustained as much as I can, sustained Zazen practice. This Sangha has shaped my feelings about Zazen. I love to sit now. I didn't used to like to sit. Sitting was tolerated so that I could do the fun stuff, the put on the kesa, the light the incense very ceremonially, do the funerals, do the weddings, all the stuff that didn't cause me to sit down and have pain in my knees. But over time, there's a softening, there's a tenderness that presents itself if I just keep sitting. So that's goal and pathway. And then agency is trust. Trust in the process. Trust in allowing koans to do their work. You know, I resist. I get a new koan. It's the most amazing thing. In Dokusan, we all know this. You finish a koan, and then, have we done this one? Have we done that one? There's no time. There's no rest. There's no like, why don't you go back to your cushion and enjoy the fact that you've just answered your koan, sit there and glow for a few minutes, and then next Dokusan, I'll give you another koan. No, it's, hey, have we done this one? Hey, have we done that one? What about this one? You know, it's sustained. It's a process. And it's beautiful. It's beautiful. And the agency, I think, from a Zen perspective, comes in trusting that. And the trust deepens over time. At first, you know, I came to Zen I thought it was something else. I didn't know it was going to be sitting. I thought it was Zumba. You know, I thought it was Zazen. It was sitting. So a mistake led me to Zen practice. Did I trust Zen practice right away just because I lost my scary Sunday scaries? No, I didn't. I resisted it. I loved certain parts of it, but I resisted the Zazen. Over 20 years, that has finally started to soften, but it's only because I'm sitting more. You know, Kurt said it takes a lot of sitting. Kurt says that it takes a lot of sitting to wake up, and I trust what he says. So From a hope standpoint, it's I want Daikensho. I know the pathway. It's Zazen sustained with koan practice and all the other things that our Sangha offers, Sesshin, and agency, trusting that. So from a hope standpoint, that is not an emotional state. Koans take me sometimes into very dark emotional places. Sometimes they take me into really, really nice and light emotional places. But as with that framework, there's no way to make a mistake. So then experience. Let's talk about experience and then strength. So, yeah, okay. So I have been, I've battled certain things about practice over time. One of the things that was really helpful in the early days of Zoom, with Joe's help, we finally figured out how to do the audio portion of Zoom early on, when we couldn't meet at all together, and we would do the sutra recitation with one person reciting and everybody else kind of following along, and I got to volunteer to do that. Again, with Joe's help, we got the right AV stuff and it worked. And so for about a year and a half, every other Saturday, I would be reciting, like, especially the Lotus Sutra, which is what, like 15 minutes or so? And I couldn't swallow. Because if you swallow, there's no sound that comes out. So I got the rhythmic, but at some point there was like this froth at the end and spittle was going everywhere. I was at my house, but stuff was going everywhere and I couldn't stop. And by the time we got back together and we stopped using that equipment as regularly, that effect was gone. I could relatively comfortably recite the Lotus Sutra without frothing. Now that sounds crazy, but that was a very powerful experience for me with this aspect of the practice. And just sitting, you know, I have a little bit of neuropathy related to a hereditary genetic defect that I found about recently in my legs. So I get a little bit of edema during sesshin. And the first two or three days are comfortable. But after that, and the edema starts, the swelling starts, it starts to get really painful. But I've been working with that, sesshin after sesshin after sesshin. And this most recent one, it almost didn't develop. So, you know, there is a give. There's a resource, like this resource that I don't even know I have. I don't know where I myself get this resource, but something is enabling this continued softening and tenderness to present itself. And about, you know, when it comes to this koan, there was an experience, and I think Kurt has said this, and that we can be pretty detailed about our experiences with these koans, because if you've had this koan and had a good had a response, then you will know for yourself. If you haven't had the koan, it won't make any sense at all, which is okay. But with this particular koan, at a Saturday sit, I've worked on sitting through the long sit without uncrossing my legs, just because uncrossing, there's something about the way my mind works that if I do keen heen or uncross my legs and disturb my posture, it short circuits the samadhi a little bit. So I tried to push through that, and I still have a little bit of residual hypoglycemia from my drinking years. Very small, very slight, but I keep a little container of orange slices here with me. And at the break, I'll just lean back and get one and keep the blood sugar going. So, this koan was in January. So, at one of the Saturday sits, I felt a little bit of fatigue and sugar level dropping, and I got the orange and I ate the orange, and it was just whammo, just beautiful, just delicious. But not only that, that was the first sensation. That was like first nen. And then after that, it was, this is so human. This is such a human thing. Why are you so hard on yourself? What's going on? Why are you so hard on yourself? You're not separate from anything. You know, yeah, you had colic. Yeah, you were separate. All the what the hell. But human. You're human. It's okay. And the blood sugar returned and got through the sit. And it's that subtle. It's human tenderness. You know, in my old Sangha, I thought that the idea was, I sit and I sit and I keep going back to samadhi. Go back to samadhi, keep going back, and then eventually, poof, you'll be in permanent samadhi. I know that's not the case. But I thought it was trying to strengthen myself, trying to will the pain away and fight to sit and be still. You know, when we're sitting together and we're still and we're not looking at each other, it can feel cold and off-putting. It can feel unwelcoming. I remember feeling that early on in particular, where I would see a sangha. I would maybe come into the zendo a little bit late, and my teacher would yell at me, "You're not supposed to come in the zendo late," but I would come in the zendo, and it didn't feel welcoming. But it's not that at all. It's that we're all working with our own stuff, our own koan, our own karma, to together. Together, we're together. Even when we're in Zoom, we're all together. We're electrons in the atom. And so this, you know, for me, Zen practice and waking up is not about resisting or strengthening. It's about tenderness at depth. Deep, deep tenderness. You know, and to me, the best phrase that captures this is in the Shinjin Mei. I just think this is the description of the tender human, the tender me. Just let things be in their own way, and there will be neither coming nor going. Nothing can get a grip on me when I'm tender. Nothing. So I think that's my experience with this koan, and it's such a pleasure to do this, because I'm talking about this koan, but I think what's really working itself out is the koan I have now. I've experienced that before, where if I actually give a teisho and talk, it's really coming from the koan I'm doing now. And, you know, it kind of spurs me along. And believe me, this koan needs a couple of spurs. So I really appreciate the opportunity to do this. Okay. Even as you call it thus, it's already changed. Where knowledge doesn't reach, avoid speaking of it. Here, is there any investigating or not? Case. Ruyan asked Yanto, what is the fundamental constant principle? Yanto said, moving. Ruyan said, when moving, what then? Yanto said, you don't see the fundamental constant principle. Ruyan stood there thinking. Yanto said, if you agree, you are not yet free of sense and matter. If you don't agree, you'll be forever sunk in birth and death. Caught. Verse, the round pearl has no hollows. Nothing to grip. The great raw gem isn't polished. What is esteemed by the people of the way is having no edges, nothing to grab. Removing the road of agreement, senses and matter are empty. The free body, resting on nothing, stands out unique and alive.